We're looking at Numbers chapter 29, verse 12 is where I want us to start. We're looking at kind of a recap of a year for Israel once they get into the land, particularly focusing on special worship gatherings and sacrifices and days off. We've already gone up to the fall, that is to the seventh month of the year. And we've talked about the Feast of Trumpets that happens on the first day of the seventh month. And then we talked about Yom Kippur, which is a fast day that happens on the 10th day of the month. And that pretty much leaves us in this chapter with Feast of Tabernacles. So let's read about that. Numbers 29, 12. On the 15th day of the seventh month, which is going to be a full moon, you shall have a holy convocation. Convocation means a gathering together. It's a special worship assembly. You shall do no ordinary work, or you shall not do any ordinary work. So it's a day off. Every 15th day of the seventh month is a holiday. It doesn't matter what day of the week it falls on. And you shall keep a feast to he who is for 7 days. And you shall offer a burnt offering, a food offering, with a pleasing aroma to he who is. Now listen to the number that we start with. 13 bulls from the herd, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old. They shall be without blemish. That doesn't surprise us because they're sacrifice grade. And then their grain offering, a fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each of the 13 bulls, then 2/10 for each of the 2 rams, and 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering besides the regular burnt offerings. That's the morning and evening sacrifices for each day, and its grain offerings and its drink offerings. So the Feast of Tabernacles kicks off on the 15th with a whole bunch of sacrifices, gobs of them. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles is probably one of the most celebratory of the festivals because it's after the harvest has come in. This is when the tithes are actually supposed to be brought to the tabernacle or to one of the storehouses that will be set up in the various tribal regions. And so it's really a happy time. But I want you to see that they're going to do a massive amount of sacrifices every single day of the Feast of Tabernacles. But the bull sacrifice is going to be decreasing in number each day. It's like a countdown for the festival. So in verse 17, it says, on the second day, so that's going to be the 16th, 12 bulls from the herd, not the 13 that we started with, and then the rest are all the same, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, etc., etc., including, of course, by the time we get down to verse 19, the regular offerings, morning and evening, and then all of the grain things that go with them. Verse 20, on the third day, so that's going to be the 17th, this time it'll be 11 bulls, and then all the other things are the same. Verse 23, the fourth day, it's going to be 10 bulls. Verse 26, the fifth day, 9. On the 29th, it says, on the sixth day, 8. And then we get down to verse 32. On the seventh day, 7 bulls. And then all the other sacrifices are the same. So that takes us up through the 21st. But the Feast of Tabernacles has a special closing day. Verse 35. On the eighth day, which is going to be the 22nd. You shall have a solemn assembly. So we're back to that special gathering. You shall not do any ordinary work. So It's a day off from work, which pretty much guarantees in most years the Feast of Tabernacles have probably 3 days of no work attached to it. So the 2 special days that begin and end the Feast of Tabernacles, plus whatever Sabbath falls during that week. And then you shall, verse 36, offer a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to he who is, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old. Notice this time it's not the 14. Without blemish. And then all the grain and drink offerings that go with that. And then by the time we get to the end of verse 38, the morning and the evening sacrifices are also expected to be offered. Now, we have talked about this before, so I'm going to just quickly summarize it. In the New Testament era, we are aware from traditional understanding that the Jewish people had adopted a special ceremony for this 8th day of the Feast of Tabernacles. The high priest would go down to the pool of Siloam, which is the pool that is fed by water flowing through Hezekiah's tunnel. It's on the extreme south side of the most ancient portion of the city of Jerusalem. So the high priest would go down there and with great pomp and circumstance collect a golden container of water and then march it up steps up to the Temple Mount. And then, again, with great pomp and circumstance, would pour out water at the base of the altar of sacrifice. And this seems to be pointing both backward and forward for the Jewish celebrants at the Feast of Tabernacles. They are remembering that God always provided supernatural water in the wilderness, because the Feast of Tabernacles is all about remembering the wilderness experience. And then it looked forward to some prophecies that occur in the prophetic books of the Old Testament, that when the great kingdom comes into existence, the kingdom of the resurrection and the renewal of planet Earth, that is the new heaven and new earth in which righteousness is going to dwell, when all that occurs, there will be a spring of water bubbling up there on the Temple Mount at the site of the sacrificial altar. And this will become the water, the river of the water of life, going both westward and eastward. The eastward portion is going to go down into the Dead Sea and bring it alive, and the westward portion is going to go out to the Mediterranean. And all along, according to the prophecies in the book of Ezekiel and in the book of Revelation, all along this river of the water of life, there's going to be the tree or the forest of the tree of life, which will bear 12 crops a year, and the leaves of the trees will, the leave of this forest of trees would be for the healing of the goyim, the nations, the different people groups. And a great thing to look forward to for the Jewish people celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus, at his very last Feast of Tabernacles before going to the cross, interrupted that ceremony or came on the tail end of that ceremony and cried out loudly in the temple that anyone that would come to him from their very being would spring up rivers of living water or a great spring of living water. And the Apostle John, who's Gospel it's in, John chapter 7, said that Jesus was actually saying this about the Holy Spirit, who had not yet come because Jesus had not yet been glorified or the atonement had not taken place yet. And so this was a prophecy about the coming of the indwelling gift of the Holy Spirit. But it also, I believe, has a literal understanding about it as well, that there will be that river of the water of life that the prophetic books indicate. So that's the eighth day ceremony for the Feast of Tabernacles. It's not mentioned here in our Numbers, our Numbers 20, where are we at, 29 passage, but we know which day of the week it happened on. Okay, verse 39, back in Numbers 29, says, "These you shall offer to he who is at your appointed feasts." Hagim is the idea. It's the thing that comes up repeatedly for an assembly. "In addition to your vow offerings," those are voluntary, "and your freewill offerings for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings and for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings." So the whole reason that we went through this calendar list was to help everybody understand what their responsibility was in regard to offering sacrifices and making gatherings and taking days off throughout the year. So verse 40, Moses told the people of Israel everything just as he who is had commanded Moses. At this point, Moses has got some additional things he wants to bring up from God to the Israelis. Keep in mind, he's kind of wrapping up his ministry here. We're in the final months of Israel's 40th year of the Exodus. And Moses knows that very soon, actually in the new year, Israel will be going across the Jordan and into the Promised Land, but he will not be going with them. He already has an appointment with death. He knows where it's going to happen, and he knows that he won't make it through the rest of the year. So he's trying to get everything wrapped up in his teaching responsibility. So chapter 30 of the book of Numbers, Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, "This is what he who is has commanded." And he needs to talk about vows again. We spent some time talking about vows earlier, but this time it's in regard to who can make a binding vow. So this is what he says, verse 2. "If a man," and by this we mean an adult male, "vows a vow to he who is, and swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." And this is the reason why we have multiple Old Testament passages warning against making hasty vows and not going back on any vows you make. If you say, "I swear by he who is that I'm going to do this," you are expected to do it. And so in the New Testament, we actually have the advice given to us by Jesus because of abuses of the vow system. And then his half-brother James writes about this as well, that you should not be binding yourself by any vows. And if you do, that instead of doing so, you should let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. And so I take from that the principle that we living in the New Testament era should not take vows. That's my personal belief. That instead, we should always just mean it when we say, "Yes, I will do it," or "No, I can't do that." To be on the safe side, I think we often should say, "Maybe, it will depend, if the Lord wills," or "if I can," something along that line. because our word should be our bond. Now, back to the text. Verse 3 says, if a woman vows a vow to he who is and binds herself by a pledge while within her father's house in her youth. It would be true that any minor making a vow while under the leadership of dad, dad, has the option to say, no, you may not make that vow, because he is the head of the household. He is the team leader. Now, what happens, though, if you've got a young woman who is no longer minority age, which for the Jewish people was 20 was majority age, but she's still living at home because she's not married yet. And so that's the point of this passage. Verse 4, and her father hears of her vow and of her pledge by which she has bound herself, and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. So if she makes a vow while living with mom and dad, she's of majority age, and dad is like, yeah, it doesn't matter, that's fine. And silence is assent in this case. Then she has to keep that vow. However, verse 5, this is the point. If her father opposes her on the day that he hears it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. And he who is will forgive her, meaning not hold her to account, because her father opposes her. Because you see, she's living at home under the leadership of her dad, and so dad is team leader. And team leader can say, no, that is not an appropriate vow, or that is not a vow that you should have to keep. Verse 6, if she marries a husband while under her vows or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she has bound herself. Now, that's an interesting take on this, is that perhaps many of these vows have just been uttered really fast without thinking through it. And her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand. Same situation, just a different team leader. She's married. Her husband is the team leader in the couple. They're supposed to be functioning as a team, as a couple. But one of them has to be team leader. And so if he doesn't say anything, then yes, she is bound by what she said. However, verse 8, if on the day that her husband comes to hear of it, he opposes her, then he makes void her vow that is on her and the thoughtless utterances of her lips by which she bound herself. He who is will forgive her, meaning not hold her to account. It will be the husband, as team leader, that has to answer to God regarding him negating this vow. A little bit more detail. If any vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, anything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. Now, that's assuming, because of something we already read up above this, that she hasn't gone home to dad. She's living on her own still. So her husband died. She's not remarried. She didn't go home to dad. She's living on her own. Then her vow stands. If she's divorced, not living at home, living on her own, then her vow is individualized. She has to be responsible for it. If she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by a pledge with an oath, and her husband heard of it and said nothing to her and did not oppose it, then all her vows shall stand, every pledge by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband makes them null and void on the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning vows or concerning her pledges of herself shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and he who is will forgive her. So again, you can see the principle being built up here, that a woman that's in a team, her team leader can say, no, that would not be good. You can't be forced to keep that vow that you made in the name of God. But if she's on her own as a majority age woman, then she is accountable to God for everything that she vows. If her husband says nothing to her from day to day, then he establishes all her vows and all her pledges that are upon her. He's established them because he said nothing to her on the day that he heard of them. So silence is assent. But if he makes them null and void after he's heard of them, then he shall bear her iniquity. So like I said earlier, as the team leader, he becomes responsible for saying, no, you can't do that. Now, I've seen this in practical principle in New Testament situations where a minor child has wanted to become a Christian, be immersed into the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And dad, and often it's mom, says, no, you may not do that. And as much as the child wants to do it, they have to follow the lead of mom and dad. And so I also would love to help the kid out, but I can't. And so I very often tell them, it's okay, because God is not going to help hold you responsible for what your mom and dad are telling you right now. Just hang in there, and maybe they'll change their mind over time, or you'll eventually be out on your own. You'll be an adult, and you can make your choice on your own. I've also had a couple that was mixed, as in one was a Christian, one was not a Christian. And in this case, it was the wife that was the Christian. And she wanted to give money to the church. She wanted to give a tithe. But her husband specifically said, no, you are not going to be giving any of this money away. And the wife was very upset about this because she felt that it was important to support the Lord's work. And I said, don't worry about it, because your responsibility is to be in this relationship with your husband. He's the team leader in this situation. He will be held accountable by God for this choice, not you. So don't worry about it. And so this is one of the things we can do when we're applying Old Testament principles to New Testament situations. And I by the way, I'd be kind of interested in some of your responses to those examples that I just gave. So you can always contact me. Verse number 16, we say, these are the statutes that he who is commanded Moses about a man and his wife and about a father and his daughter while she is in her youth within her father's house. Chapter 31, and we knew this was coming. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Now you remember, the Midianites were they were allies of the king of Moab in trying to get Balaam to curse the Israelis so that the Israelis could be defeated by the Moabite Midianite army. And that all fell apart. But apparently the Midianite portion of this alliance wouldn't let it go. And so Balaam gave advice to the Midianite leadership that I can't verbally curse them, but if you get them to sin against God's commandments, he'll curse them. And so that involved throwing a big pagan party at Baal Peor and inviting a bunch of Israelis to it. And yes, it happened exactly as Balaam predicted. God judged the sinful participation of the Israelis over that. However, God holds the Midianites accountable for leading those people into sin. And so now they are going to pay a price for being used in that fashion. He says, avenge the people of Israel and the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. So this will be one of the last acts of Moses, is to oversee the Midianite reprisal campaign. And it's happening toward the end of the 40th year of the Israeli time in the wilderness. Verse 3, so Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you for the war, that you may go against Midian to execute he who is his vengeance on Midian. Notice that it is God directing this. The Israelis didn't come up on this on their own. So this is God's punishment for the sin of Midian. You shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to war. So 12,000 soldiers. So there were provided out of the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them to war, 1,000 from each tribe, together with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, with the vessels of the sanctuary and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. So Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, the son of the current high priest Eleazar, the man who actually killed one of the Israelis that was continuing this sinful practice with the Midianites in the encampment next to the tabernacle. He is sent as the chaplain of the war effort, and he brings with him certain parts or pieces from the tabernacle, but also brings the communication equipment, the two silver trumpets that will be used. And so that is the background that we're setting up for this reprisal war against Midian that we'll talk about the next time we get into the Word.